On this wild and haunting night, we gather together on All Hallows' Eve to tell tall tales for young and for old. We invite you to snuggle down behind the sofa or under the covers with torches under your chins. In these six short stories, you will find ghosts, ghouls, fairies, dwarves, and monsters alike. The stories have been written, produced, and performed by artists all from the northeast of England, and are brought to you by folk. So settle down, take a deep breath, and we wish you all a horrifying All Hallows Eve.
Are you sitting comfortably? You should be on this night. A night where the veil thins between our world and the other world. An eve to remember when all is not as it seems, of the spirits of the memories we see in our dreams. The stories of monsters, ghouls, and the fae. Smells of pumpkins, spices, wood, and decay. What tales we have to tell you on this night, on an eve that is hallowed, for after all, this is All Hallows' Eve.
A series of short Halloween stories produced by Folk, a Northeast creative collective. In Spookters, written by Matthew Nicholson. Voiced by Liam Scarth as Big Spook, Nathan Jones as Little Spook, narrated by Alex Tarney.
Friday the 13th, the spookiest time. 'Tis when I deliver this spookiest rhyme. This tale takes place in a long-forgotten room, on a day filled with sunshine, but a night filled with gloom. From out of the woodwork pop two little spectres, sent from the underworld as Lucifer's inspectors. Their singular task to study and explore every last detail from ceiling to floor. We join our friends at the start of their night. They work in secret, so as not to cause fright. This ethereal visitor and his partner in crime commence their work on the 12 o'clock chime. Though not a word betwixt them is spoken, they know their work ends when morning has broken. You may not believe us, but we tell you it's true. So join me for the tale of two chums that go boom.
Anyone is in. It Looks like whoever lived here has been gone for a long, long time.
Well, that explains why it's so spooky.
Hey, don't get scared now. There's lots of stuff here that needs inspecting. Besides, we're the ghosts, remember?
Right. Got it. I shall show no fear, no surrender, for I am...
Come on. The sooner we inspect this place, the sooner we can head back.
He had spotted a creature, just 1 foot in height, who was fluffy and soft and full of delight. The creature seemed calm and caring and nice, but something about it made little Spook look twice.
Hey, look!
Wait! Could be dangerous. Let me scope it out first.
You don't need to... You seem braver all of a sudden.
Trying to make a good impression on this, my first mission, my most important mission. The fate of the world rests in my ethereal hands, and I will succeed, even if it kills me again.
Well, that's very good to hear, but I think this is just a normal, run-of-the-mill teddy. A big, fluffy... cuddly guy.
Of this bear, Big Spook was particularly fond. They seemed to share a pre-existing bond. This was a bear which brought déjà vu. But they moved on, as there was more inspecting to do.
But, no time for that now. There's inspecting to be done, and we only have so much time before daylight, so let's get moving. Like this item.
A mysterious object entered their view. A small little box which puzzled the two. They had no idea what it was for or why it was lying alone on the floor.
Ooh, what is it?
You know, I'm not sure. I used to have a box that looked oddly familiar, but for the life of me, I can't remember what it did.
Boxy, spinning things.
Just be sure not to touch. For all we know, it could be a bomb or something.
Button?
No! Radio, of course.
What other stations do you have?
I'm not sure. Let's see, shall we? This is my jam.
Sleeping in your bed.
Let's just note everything down and get out of here.
Yes, sir.
And we never touch the radio again.
Yes, sir.
All righty then.
Boxy, spinny things, flashy bits, interlevel, screen, eyes, maybe.
Oh, strange.
The little one had sprang towards an old-looking book and opened its pages to have a quick look. What he found inside neither thrilled nor amazed, and yet at his side, Big Spook looked fazed. Poring over the words inside, he started to realize the place he had died was an awful lot similar to where they were now. He continued to read, wiping sweat from his brow. Further and further into the book, Big Spook earnestly continued to look. Each word was familiar, each sentence he knew, every anecdote or story he remembered them too. He didn't know how or why this was happening, why he related so much to this babbling, when suddenly, in his mind, an almighty boom. It had dawned on Big Spook. This was his room!
This is my diary. That's my radio. Teddy! That's my Teddy. Oh, Teddy, I'm sorry for ever leaving you. Oh, my sweet little Ted.
You called it Ted?
Wait, what's the time?
Huh, almost midnight. Guess time flies when you're having...
I can't leave Ted again.
What if we just stay?
Ooh, we can't just stay. In my old room? There's inspecting to be done.
I'm sure Lucifer won't miss us. He's the devil.
Oh, he's a softy, really.
No, I mean, he's the literal devil. Anyways, you've been doing this for your whole afterlife. I think you deserve a break.
What about you?
Well, I've been with you for my whole afterlife, so I think I deserve a break, too.
Well, you only died yesterday.
Exactly.
What do you say, Ted? Thanks, Ted. You always know the perfect thing to say.
That's the sun coming up now. Are we going back home or what?
I think we already are.
For years... or a day, they'd endlessly roamed, hoping to find a place to call home. And now they had found it, in Big Spook's old bed, a place they could finally rest their heads. And so our story comes to a close. What happened to them next, nobody knows. But sadly, we must say adieu to the bestest of friends who like to go boo. Now I must exit quickly, for there's more spooking to be done.
The Gosforth Maggot. Weekend day to church, not me. I'll wander to the Dean and see if luck awaits and I can catch something for tea with chips I'll match. And what is this upon my line? It's not a fish, this beast of slime. I don't think that this could be dressed to resemble anything other than a total mess. I do not know how it could be cooked, this monstrous thing that I have hooked. No face can I see, nor limbs, nor shell. 'Tis like a maggot that has swelled. I should throw it back and start again, but then it could be caught by other men. Instead, I'll toss it in this well. At home it'll feel that close to hell. Before long, this beast had been forgot. How many years passed? A lot. That thing, it grew and swelled in size. Identification it defies, but in its wake destruction lies. Upon its approach it elicits cries. Oh Lord, what's that, this beastly sight? Please save us from this monstrous blight. It devoured my child, shoes and all. Can nothing stop this demon's crawl? In vain 'twas tried to cause its death. Attempts all failed to choke its breath. It would not stab, nor bruise, nor bleed. Relentlessly it did proceed, devouring houses, streets, then towns. With each new feed it grew long and round, until so vast round a hill did twist, 7 times the sight could not be missed. Clearly seen from miles away, this creature now had finally lay. The killing stopped, but for how long? Could it be killed, this beast so strong? Throughout this time, I came to know, I had caused this thing to grow. It was indeed the catch I made that day when from the church I'd strayed. I came to think, could I end this tale? Accomplish that at which all others failed? I had to try, so some advice I sought from the wise and learned one of thought. They did recommend I wear some armour, and for peace of mind this made me calmer, but I should affix upon my chest some spearheads like a spiky vest. I did as bid and approached the hill, standing brave, wondering how to kill. Idle too long the thing did wake, in my boots I stood and quaked. Before I could thrust it with my stake, the creature encircled me like a snake. But as this foul maggot squeezed me to death, my spikened armour ripped its flesh. The more it grabbed, the more it tried, more pieces of it fell to the side. In vain it coiled, for with each turn, huge chunks detached, it did not learn. A river's worth of blood had spilled, and then the beast was at last killed. I left the scene without hearing praise, as I knew my past I could not erase. Never waiting for a hero's cheer, something I did not want to hear. For meaning to this tale I've searched, and some say it's 'cause I avoided church, a punishment for my sin back then. But why include the countless men, women, children, all who died, as an attempt to teach me religious pride? I doubt a god would choose this course as a learning aid without remorse. This creature foul that caused vexation, more likely a biological aberration. Still, on Sundays I do fish. I do not pray, but sometimes wish that all I catch are things to eat, and not a thing that thinks of me as meat.
Modern Monster Dating. Written by Jake Wilson Craw. Voiced by Helen Coverdale and Adam Lowe. Should we get a bottle of wine? They've got a rather cheeky rosé here.
Oh, not for me, thank you. I never drink wine.
Oh, a lager then? Or one of those big gins they have these days? I had a flavoured one the other day. What was it? Oh, a ploughman's gin. Chutney and Stilton it was. And it came with a slice of apple and a little pickled onion in it.
Oh, they're taking it too far these days. I can't keep up.
What's your favourite flavour of gin then?
Oh, I don't know. Blood orange, I suppose.
Oh, that sounds nice. I haven't tried that one. Are we doing starters and mains? Because I am loving the look of those garlic mushrooms. Oh, not a fan of mushrooms. Is anything catching your eye?
I think I'll have the steak. Extra, extra rare.
Oh, that's not for me. I don't like it bloody. I like it to be well done.
Of course. What I'm really looking forward to is dessert.
I was surprised when you said you wanted a steak.
What?
You heard me. I didn't think you people would be into that.
What do you mean, you people?
I mean that I know your secret. Well, you are hardly subtle in your profile.
You put your age as 589. All your photos were at night, and with blokes that, though you blocked their faces, were clearly eating flies. I mean, there's goths, and then there's this. And your opening gambit. Instead of just saying, hey, like everyone else does, what did you say?
Bleh!
And you've got a pet impala called Vlad. So, yes, it was suspicious, but also intriguing. I had to know if you were the real deal. I've been disappointed so many times in the past. There was that supposed Sasquatch who just turned out to be a real tall, hairy hippie. That fake phantom who was just a grand wizard in the KKK. That hoax headless spectre who was just an angry amusement park owner in a costume. And that werewolf that just turned out to be a randy Irish setter. So, imagine my delight when we sat down by that mirror behind you and I can only see myself looking back at me.
Well, yes, about that, I don't mean you any harm.
No. Hush. It's nothing to get defensive about. We all have our needs, urges. And in fact, I'm into it.
You're into it?
I've always thought that Draculas were incredibly sexy. Big, drafty castles, the high collar capes, the hypnotic glares, the turning into bats, the piercing pain as your fangs puncture my porcelain neck. Oh, just thinking about it has my blood boiling. Hey, what say we skip dinner and go straight to the main course?
Wow, yes. That sounds incredible. But I feel I must tell you the truth. It's just one minute detail that it doesn't work quite like that. So, yes, we have castles and capes and, well, as for a hypnotic glare, you tell me. Yeah. But we don't actually bite necks or do the bat thing. I think that Stoker fella just wanted to make us a bit sexier. No, once you're seduced, we're just like many other ectoparasites in that we locate a suitable feeding spot on your person, cut a hole in your epidermis, and insert a hypostome. It's sort of a calcified harpoon-like protrusion, and keeping the blood from clotting by excreting an anticoagulant from our glands will latch on for 3 or 4 hours as our feeding sacs engorge this blood, and we become 5 to 10 times heavier than our unfed weight. At which point we detach, crawl off, and wait in some undergrowth for our next victim.
So, sort of like a tick, then?
Yes, sort of like a tick. So, do you still fancy it?
Yeah, all right then. Well, it can't be any worse than that werewolf.
Written by Adam Lowe. Voiced by Molly Farquhar.
I moved in when I was 27. It was so exciting to have my own place, and I immediately began planning the whole house, room by room, imagining what it could look like. I really found my feet and had a brief fantasy of a radical career change. Becoming an interior designer or something. I think it happens to a lot of people. I wouldn't say I was delusional. Just content. Anyway, the excitement faded and life became very normal. But I never lost that contentedness. That pride from having my own house. Time passed, as it does, and I lived my life in my house. My children grew up here. My mother nearly died here. Just over there, where your sofa is now, I had a wingback chair there. My mum loved it. Whenever she visited, if someone else was sat there, she'd hover and edge over until they felt, I don't know, uncomfortable or something. They'd always offer her the chair and move. She'd almost pounce at the second they were up and settle in with her handbag held firmly in her lap. I always thought that was pretty funny. So many years. So many memories. It's difficult to tease it apart and think of individual moments. I can recall it all, but only the way you might think about a film or a story. I can picture all the characters, but names keep slipping away, and I dare say I'm confusing or conflating a lot of details. It all seems so significant, like there's something tying it all together. Suppose the only thing is me. I'm the common denominator. And well, I just never left. I don't know if it's something I did or didn't do, but here I am. And here you are too. I wonder if you feel the same about this house, the way I did all those years ago. I don't follow you around, not really. Well, not that much. Sometimes I think you're looking right at me. I get all excited and stare back. I try to force you to acknowledge me, but you're always just gazing into the middle distance or lost in your own thoughts. If you did suddenly see me, I'd be jumping up and down and screaming and waving. Probably not the best first encounter, eh? I like you. I'm not sad to share this house with you. It's nice to have a family here again. It's just all so one-sided. I suppose I'm sick of my own company. Sometimes I turn your kettle on. You just thought it was dodgy and eventually bought a new kettle. I couldn't keep going because I'd just cost you a fortune in kettles. I've written on your bathroom mirror too. Nothing too spooky, just hello. Though, I suppose, that would be pretty spooky, if you'd even noticed it. Over the years, I've done a lot of things to try and get your attention. Touching things like kettles and mirrors is really hard to describe, as I'm not sure how I do it and I can't always get it right. It's sort of like the opposite of concentrating. I have to forget that's what I'm trying to do and absent-mindedly interact with something. I hid those earrings you lost. But it was an accident. I tried to pick them up and they just vanished. I have no idea where they went. Weird. I'm sorry. Hopefully they'll turn up somewhere. Your friend's dog saw me once. I was always a little scared of dogs and wondered if it could sense fear. It just stared at me, right in the eyes. It was so intense. I moved around the room to see if it followed me, but it just looked like to you, like it was chasing its tail. I can't see out of the windows, which took some getting used to. I wonder what the world looks like now. I make myself laugh sometimes, imagining flying cars and robots everywhere. I'm pretty sure it'll all be the same as ever, though. I wish there was more. I wish I was more. Or less.
As the light drains from the sky, our stories also begin to take on a darker hue. For those of a nervous disposition or younger in age, we advise you to turn away now before it is too late. For those who are staying, those who are brave of heart, we invite you to turn out your lights and see how brave you truly are. Let us continue.
Fog on the Tyne, written by Michelle Bailey, voiced by Andrew Neal.
It came on the night of All Hallows Eve. As I looked out on the Tyne, it's black water still. The gas lamps burned dull orange in the reflection. It was eerie calm, the streets quiet, and only the faint echo of my footsteps as I walked along the docks. A damp, misty fog lay around my feet. It was brisk, so I'd worn me thick long coat, good for fishing and keeping the cools off me neck now the seasons had changed. Pipe in mouth, strike a match, the fire burning under me brow. Took ages to light the salty wet baccy and breathe the smoke in. Coughing. Damn coughing, yakking. The cold's not being kind to me this year. I heave and yak and fall to me knees to catch up with myself. But what's that? A young slip of a thing. Out at neat and dressed all pale like in a nighty. I stare at her. She hugs the wet walls of the stockyard. Wet hair stuck to her pale blue cheeks. She looks wet through. The nighty clinging to her skin, specks of dirt here and there. Are you all right, lassie? I whisper so as not to fright her. But she scoppers away. Mind me face and statue is enough to scare the most grown of folk, now mind a young lassie. But what was she doing all wet and alone? Surely. Nah, it's me mind, man. This damn cold's got us harsher than me mind can take. I take a breath, pull myself back up and just have a peek to check me mind and eyes against each other. Nout. Nout but the silent fog and the black of the Tyne beneath. So I continue along the dockside and past the strangest straggly looking black dog. No, horse. No, it is a dog. A bloody big dog and all. Nae horse sits like that. It sits, never taking its quiet, sullen eyes from us as I pass. I swear they shine white silver. But that's the reflection of the lamps, man. This cowl's got us summat rotten. I wipe me heavy, dirty hands across me face, compose myself and tap out me pipe against the rails. Peeking every now and then, back at that dog. Still it sits, quietly watching us. Yeah, you fancy leaving your dog roaming wild, man. So I put the pipe away, cough burbling in me throat again. I hack it out for a while and try to regain myself. Hey, this fog is laying on me chest, something thick. I check back at the dog. Gone. Must have wandered off, like the girl. Did I really see it? I turned to continue towards home. Small shack, built behind the factories and storehouses along the river. It's small but close for labour work. Wonder if the ships will come by for the whaling this winter. Fresh sea air will do me lungs some good, away from the coal and smog of city life. I've been working for some minutes now, eyes doing at me feet in solemn thoughts of another year like the year before and the year before. Life ever repeating, day in, day out. When I look up, the fog's grown thicker. It's almost white now. Sea fret. Tide's coming in. Then a faint sound. Crying. Oh, that fog. Hello? Is everything all right? I continue towards the sound. The crying gets louder. Sounds like a young girl. Could it be? Hello? I try and make my way through the fog, so thick I can barely see. I scuffle along the railing by the river, holding on, occasionally tripping on oakum, rocks and fishing traps. Crying gets louder until I reach the ladder. Louder. Louder. And stops. I look down the ladders to the river below. Surely not. I lean over, peering through the fog. Hello? Something brushes against me side. Black fur. The dog. Its head turned towards us, glaring. The crying begins again from below. Hello? Can you hear us? The dog barks and snarls at us, and that crying gets louder. I climb over and Dune taking it step by step. I'm coming, Dune! Stay where you are! I expect to find deep water beneath us, but my foot lands on wet, dark sand. The bank. I scramble a run while the barking echoes above, and that cry becomes a wail, growing louder, more surreal the closer I get. Walking, rummaging, trying to see through the fog, and it grows louder still. Waves crash, yet all I can see is white fog, dark sand. My ears filled with the barking, wailing and pounding water. I trip. Fall. Wet sand rushes into me face, me eyes, me mouth. Hello! I call again, coughing and spluttering. I grab a rope nearby and pull. The wailing now a screech all around us. The rope feels heavy. Pull again. That screeching's getting louder. Pull again. Coughing, spluttering, barking, screeching. Pull. 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 She's lying there. Still. Her dress soaked. Skin pale as blue. Seaweed entwined in her hair. Poor Ben. She's bound. Her hair matted in dark blood. I pick her up. She looks to be about 6, 7. Drowned. Clubbed. Oh, she's such a tiny thing. Such a precious, femme little thing. All I can think to do is comfort her. I hold her close in my arms, tears streaking down my mud-soaked face. Oh, my heart breaks for her, for her family. I hold her, rock her, and close my eyes for a moment. Her skin feels leathery to the touch. Her body a heavy, weighted lump. When I open my eyes, the fog has cleared. I look down. A seal. A dead, fishy-smelling seal in my arms. Its heed battered in, blood and bone falling out. A heavy lap of water splashes my way and hits us full in the face. In the face? I'm in a pool of water. No bank. Just water, heavy black water weighted down by the dead seal. So I drop it and the barking starts again. I look up to see lamplight and shadow at the top of the ladder. I try to swim towards it, but something has us. Something is holding me feet fast and has us all fouled up. I pull, but I'm snagged. The water rises rougher now in waves. Go beneath. Untrap myself. The feeling of a million tiny hands clutching at us, pulling us below. I scarper, trying to pull myself towards the ladder, but there's the dog, at the top, barking down at his teeth bared. My arm shoots up, desperately trying to pull me soaking body out. Evermore, something grips tighter, pulling us back. Filthy water rushes into my mouth. The taste makes us splutter, gag, cough and hack. Grip's gone. Back down. Swallow again. Distant now. The barking continues, and the screeching. Fog. The fog. I splutter, try to call for help. Cough, hack, sinking. Sinking below. I reach for something, anything, but all my desperate fingers find is dark water. And still, I feel the vice-like grip pulling us into the depth of the night water. With one final cough, my burning lungs give out. And surrender to the deep.
Widow, written by Devon Young, voiced by Hayley Harrison as Karen, Jake Wilson-Craw as Paul, narrated by Matthew Nicholson.
Interior entrance hall. Night. Silent. Still. It's a large hall. Tasteful and extravagant furnishings. Yet tidy and ordered. A frosted window embedded into the large oak front door. A potted plant rustles. Then voices start to rise from outside. Slurred, drunken, oh, yeah, and playful.
This one?
What?
Sure.
Two shadows appear behind the glass.
1 second.
One fumbles. The other holds the first, arms wrapped around.
Here, shut up.
Keys jingle. The lock rattles.
Shit.
Keys jingle again.
It's the wrong house, isn't it?
The lock rattles.
Okay, come on, we'll go to my...
The lock clicks open.
See?
The door swings open, and in stumbles Karen, a woman in her late 30s, in a low-cut top, and Paul, a man in his late 30s, with a creased shirt. Paul shuts the door as Karen struggles to take off her heeled boots. The plant falls over.
Careful!
He stands the plant back up as Karen gets her shoes off. She stands, faces him.
Well?
Well?
Grins. They make out, drunkenly.
Come on.
She yanks him through the hall to a wide stairway, snaking up to the landing hall. The walls are lined with framed photos. Some of Karen, some of the two children across a range of ages, and some turned around, hanging with their face against the wall. They stumble into the hall, make out again. Karen lifts Paul's shirt, tries to pull it over his head. It gets caught on his chin. She pulls harder, stumbling back as it pops off.
Shh. It's fine.
She pulls him down the hall, into the door at the very end. Karen closes and locks the door behind them, and throws Paul's shirt into the corner of the room. She lays on the bed, stretching her arms out and grinning. Paul leans over her, kissing her. She rolls over, pushing him down, climbing on top of him.
Close your eyes.
Paul does. Karen takes off her top, puts Paul's hands on her breasts. There's a quiet knock at the door. Paul opens his eyes, pulls Karen in for another kiss. There's another knock at the door. Paul pauses. Puts his hand on Karen's shoulders, She carries on. A thud emanates from the landing. Paul pushes Karen up. She stops, looks at him, confused.
Are we alone?
Yeah.
But I saw kids.
They're our friends. It's fine.
Paul glances back at the door. Nothing.
Okay, sorry.
He smiles, rolls Karen onto her back, lays beside, kissing her, sliding his hand down her stomach. The lock rattles on the door.
Fuck!
He stands.
Who is that?
It was just the wind.
That wasn't the wind.
It's fine. Please, just have some fun. It's okay.
Paul bites his tongue, sighs.
One second.
He unlocks the door, opens it, and steps out into the landing hall. Silent, still, empty.
Hello?
Come on.
He steps back into the bedroom, and a scrape emanates from the child's room. Paul walks back onto the landing, leaving the bedroom door wide open. He slowly walks toward the child's room, looks back to the bedroom. Karen sits on the bed, looking after him, lips pursed, jaw tight. Slowly, Paul pushes inside. Paul steps inside, looks around. A ruffled duvet on a small bed. He flicks the light switch. Nothing. He gets out his phone, turns on the torch, looks around again. The bed is made. The room is empty. He notices a framed photo on the bedside table. A man in his early 30s, sitting beside a young boy. He picks it up, peers closer, and the glass smashes, cracks centering on the face of the man. He drops the photo.
Shit!
He picks it back up, and the glass is unbroken. The man is gone. The boy is alone.
What the fuck?
The door slams shut.
Paul?
He jumps up, opens the door, and runs into the landing hall. Karen still sits on the bed. She looks terrified.
Did you shut the door?
She doesn't respond. Paul walks towards her into the bedroom.
Karen, I'm not kidding. What are you trying to...
The door to the child's room slams again. Paul looks back.
Okay.
Don't...
Karen watches Paul walk into the child's room, throw open the door, and he's thrown back by an invisible force crashing into the opposite wall. Karen screams. Paul slowly stands. On the walls around him, turned around photos start shaking. He gets to his feet. They start flipping round one by one. Each contains a photo of the man, either alone or with Karen and the children. Paul looks up at Karen.
I'm sorry.
Paul takes a step towards her, and he's slammed into the wall again. Small objects start flying from the shelves, pelting Paul.
Please, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
Paul's head snaps up. He rises, writhing, as if being lifted by an invisible hand.
It won't happen again. It was one moment of weakness. I swear. I promise I love you, Mike. You know that, please.
Paul rises higher, higher, until his feet are an inch from the ground, hovering in the air.
Please, please, just let him go.
A long moment of silence. Then, Paul's head lurches to the wall, and Paul screams as he's yanked away, then swung back and... The screams stop. Paul slumps unconscious, blood soaking down his head as he's pulled back, and then thrown harder than ever before into...
Times Are Changeling, written by Liam Scarth. Voiced by Eleanor Beck as Fran, William Steele as Fairy and Rowan, Michelle Bailey as Fairy and Dawn, Stephanie Taylor as Lydia and Belle, Emma Heidelman as Ancestor Fran and Sandra, Amy Lee as Bar Lady and Kirsty, and Matthew Nicholson as the Druga. narrated by Liam Scarth.
For centuries, the two worlds of fairy folk and humans have been divided. Across the moors of Northumberland, the dwarven tribes of the Dwalga have inhabited the hills at night, and the humans would be free to farm there in the day. Geists would roam the marshlands where danger lurked for any human. Now the divide between these peoples is more cavernous than ever. Fairy folk, dwarves, dragons are a thing of storybooks and fireside stories. However, it was not always this way. At one time, humans and queer folk lived side by side in harmonious balance. Our good friend, the hob thrush, would contently do all the menial tasks about the home without a gift or a thank you. So much so that if you did leave a gift for the hob thrush, they would never return to help again. Or how about the wag of the war? A dwarven creature that would sit in the heated hearth of the kitchen, clattering pots and assisting the cook. These fine friends have all but vanished. Only our memories serve us now. Although there are those who would see the end of any evidence of these people's existence. They would say they have good reason. This is a story of one of those people. Let this tale recite the happenings of those fateful days so that you can decide if they have reason enough. Long ago, when man and fairy folk lived as neighbours, there were many times when each world would cross paths. It was common occurrence for humans to offer attendance to fairy families. Each of the parties would thrive if the conditions of the meeting were honoured. However, humans, having been cursed with the endless desire for more, would repeatedly bend these encounters in their own favour. Many would say it was human nature. Even more intriguing, however, is what can be said about fairy nature. This tale begins in the middle of another. A midwife, by the name of Lydia, had been sent for by a physician on the outskirts of Blanchland. As it was getting dark, she packed her bag, saddled up, and rode to the estate in the greatest haste, arriving just as the dusk was settling into the long dark of night. The physician greeted Lydia at the gate and introduced himself as Rowan, then rushed along to the servants' quarters. As they approached the heavy wooden door of the bedroom, they could hear the howls and screams of a woman in labour. Lydia burst through the door with the physician close behind. Lydia set down her bag and began to calm the servant with soothing words. She was in such a state.
Oh, no, sir. I can't afford a midwife. Oh, send her away.
Screamed the woman, writhing back and forth, scratching at the wood of the bed frame, leaving hollow marks gouged in the grain. Seeing that the woman may not survive the birth, Lydia dismissed any payment and set to work. However, nothing Lydia did would calm her. Without a word, Rowan darted out of the room. In a few moments, he returned with a glass jar filled with powder. He instructed Lydia to administer some of this to the servant's thighs. He said it would calm the spasms and ease the pain. However, he warned her not to get even a speck of it in her eyes. Lydia, desperate for anything to help the woman, applied the powder and set to work. The work was hard and the room hot. Sweat began to develop across Lydia's brow. After hours of labour, a newborn entered the world. So relieved that the mother and the baby were safe, Lydia hardly noticed when she drew her hand across her eyes to remove the sweat that was pooling atop the bridge of her nose. A sharp pain rushed into her eyes. She doubled over, wincing in pain. As she blinked her eyes open and her focus began to return, she noticed that the woman had vanished. So had the baby. So had the bed and even the walls. Lydia found herself in a deep forest, surrounded by floating candles. A cool breeze rustled through the leaves. Suddenly, stepping through the ferns was a kingly-looking figure with bright blonde hair, pale skin, and silken, unfurling wings. Lydia stepped back in shock as behind the figure stepped a young winged female carrying a small bundle. As she backed away, Lydia found herself tripping over a bed of flowers and ivy. Now frozen in fear, Lydia stared wide-eyed at her new-found visitors.
We gracefully thank you for your kind toil that brought our new babe into this world,
spoke the man. His voice flowed like a cool stream as he presented the bundle to Lydia. She looked into the bundle to find a tiny creature with a pointed nose, blonde hair, and piercing blue eyes.
Who are you?
Lydia tremored, trying her best to restrain the fear in her voice. The man laughed, as if Lydia was playing dumb.
Well, it is I, Rowan. Who else would it be? This is my wife, Dawn. I apologize for any misleading, but I had to be sure you were of pure heart and not led by profiting off monetary expense. You showed a great virtue by helping Dawn without payment. We cannot thank you enough. Therefore, we wish to...
No! Sorry. I don't know who you are. You are not Rowan. You have wings!
Rowan and Dawn looked at each other, then slowly turned to Lydia.
You mean you can see... these.
In a hushed flurry, they both unfurled their glorious wings. The moon cast a rainbow of colour as it passed through the ghostly membrane. Lydia stared in silent awe as the two of them approached.
Tell me, Lydia, with what eyes do you see us?
Dawn breathed. She was now staring directly into Lydia's eyes with mysterious curiosity. In an instant, Lydia realized who was staring back at her. It was no servant girl, but a fairy queen. Lydia's eyes began to sting so badly that she blinked rapidly to see clearly again.
Do your eyes sting, my dear?
Yes, I can hardly keep them open.
Let us fix that for you.
At once, Dawn and Rowan sucked in a rush of air. The forest shuddered as a breeze rocketed through the leaves, and with a sharp burst, the fairies blew into Lydia's eyes. All at once, Lydia was plunged into darkness. The forest went silent. Warmth began to flow around her. She felt around her to find the comfort of a bed. She bent her nose to the sheet and smelt the coziness of her own linen. She searched for a candle to light the room. She stumbled into her bedside table, knocking her water jug to the floor. Suddenly, she heard a door open, accompanied with a blast of cold air and a familiar voice.
Mother, what are you doing?
It was her daughter, Francesca.
Oh, Fran, help me find a candle. It's so dark in here. I have had such a terrible dream.
But Mother, the fire is on.
The realization crept into Lydia like the dawn smooths a night sky into day. She began to weep, for she now knew that never again would she see the sun rise. Her days will forever be night. The pub was bristling with warm cheer and flowing ale. The Winged Dawn was renowned for its fine food and honest barkeep. It was the oldest pub in Blanchland. Folk music was enjoyed every night, and every other Friday the local storyteller told tall tales of years gone by. This Friday was particularly busy. It always was the weekend before Halloween. Laughter erupted from a corner table where a blonde-haired woman could be seen gesticulating wildly and bumping into tables.
Oh, come on, man. There's no way that's true,
shouted one of the lasses sat against the window. The rain slammed against the panes of glass as the autumn storm settled in.
Swear on my mother's life. That's what she told me.
What? So you're saying your family is cursed?
Swear down, every other child in my family goes blind after childbirth. Doctors actually say it's a recurring rubella infection that our genes haven't evolved to defend against.
But your grandmother demands that it's a curse laid down by a couple of fairies that blew dust in one of your ancestors' eyes.
Wrong again, Sandra. She went blind because she rubbed the powder in her eyes that they told her not to.
Jesus, Fran. You've got to stop believing these ghost stories. I know it's Halloween now, but fuck. Belle over there might be gullible as sin, but even she isn't going to believe this one.
Fuck you, Kirsty. I am not gullible. What is gullible?
It's when you have such a capable, well-rounded understanding of the world that you can easily discern what's truth and what's fiction.
Right? Oh. Well, thank you.
Belle thumbed her glass as she calculated this flattering new description of herself. The rest just polished off the last of their drinks to hide the smirks that they couldn't control. Kirsty slammed her pint glass down on the table.
Well, thank you, Fran, for such an entrancing tale. But now I need a bloody shot. Anyone else?
I'll get this round.
Ah, come on, Fran, that's not fair. You're not drinking.
It's fine. At least let me live vicariously through you. I'll savour a glass of vino in a month's time when this little crit is out of me.
As she leant on the bar, waiting for Gladys, the barmaid, to notice her, Fran pored over her grand's tale again. Why was she so adamant it happened? Why did Fran even believe her? Did she believe her?
Folk can be cruel sometimes. Especially friends.
A gravelly voice murmured, close enough to make her turn around with clenched fists. Fran's eyes fell on top of a patchy brown woolen hat. As she looked, a fiery red-bearded face emerged from underneath it as an old man looked up at her with twinkling eyes.
Could you lend an old man a helping hand? Gladys usually misses me in the crowd on the account of me size, you see. So it's mighty hard for us to get me half a strong boy. You wouldn't mind ordering it for me, would you?
At that, a fingerless glove rose out of his pocket with a tiny leather drawstring purse in it. Fran, lost in a speechless trance, just nodded and took the purse in amazement.
What a weird bloke,
she thought, as she raised a hand to get Gladys' attention, who was still busying herself with a massive order of drinks.
Did you get to hear me, Set?
You what?
Answered Fran, still frantically waving her arm in the air.
My storytelling, Set. I do it every Friday.
Suddenly intrigued, Fran turned towards the bearded man.
So it's you who tells the stories? I've only heard people talk about you. Never paid attention, really. I always thought they were for kids.
Ah. Well, you're not the only one, my dear. It's one of the great shames of our times that we have lost touch with our ancient history.
Well, it's not really history, though, is it?
Oh, no. Well, where do these tales come from, then?
Fran rolled her eyes.
They're made up by parents to stop their kids doing things they shouldn't. Like go on the moors at night. There's no such thing as dwarves that lure people on the marshes.
The old man just stared at her. The room seemed to darken. The noises of clinking glasses became a shallow muffle, and the laughter became a hollow howl. The light shot up, and the noise rushed in like a wave breaking upon the shore. Suddenly, Gladys was on the other side of the bar.
Hey up, love, what can I get you?
Just a... 3 shots and a Coke, please, Gladys.
Said Fran, darting her gaze repeatedly back to the small man who was still staring, now with an expectant smile playing on his lips.
Do you want to know my favourite folk story?
Grinned the beard.
Not really, no.
Shuddered Fran. But something drew her in closer.
It's the tales of the changelings. Fairy folk were known to steal human children in the night, and in their place, leave their own kin for the humans to raise. Just like the humble cuckoo bird. Many people used to chase their own children from their homes, believing them to be changelings. Must be true. Why would a mother do that to their own blood? You must be expecting pretty soon now, eh, lass?
A mysterious glint twinkled in the man's eye. Fran felt a rush of anxiety course up her spine.
Here you are, my love. 12:50 if you won't mind.
Fran turned to Gladys, glassy-eyed, and slammed down a 20.
Keep the change.
She grabbed the drinks and pushed herself through the crowd back to her table. Her heart was pounding. It was only after she put the drinks down on the table did she realize she had the man's purse in her pocket. She squeezed her way back through the bar in order to return it, but he was nowhere to be seen. When she finally sat back at the table, she thumbed open the purse to reveal 4 battered coins. On closer inspection, she swore they were gold. The rest of the night was a blur. Conversation flowed over her as she inspected the wood grain of the table. She couldn't shake the eyes of the old man from her mind. Something told her that this was not the last time she would be seeing him. Fran woke to the sound of screaming. It was coming from the next room.
Another sleepless night, I guess.
She thought as she dragged her feet through the dark landing.
Darling, it's all right. Mom's here. Mom's here.
After a while, the wails died down to a gentle whine, and then to silence. Fran hung her head in relief as she lay the child back in her crib. Fran didn't move. She stood there, staring down into the dark crib, blinking. A crushing sense of loneliness began to creep in. Her mind wandered to that ugly night. The night he left, he didn't even leave a note. 1 minute he was falling asleep next to her, the next his side of the bed was cold and empty. She didn't have the heart to let the baby go. Something told her that if she kept her, that he would come back. She stood some more, silently swathed in darkness. Her daughter moved as she gently dreamed. Was that hatred that she felt? How could she sleep so soundly when she was wide awake? How could she have taken everything? She drove him away. She could hardly recognize herself with these thoughts in her head. She could hardly recognize her own daughter. She was empty. The darkness closed in. She woke up to the sun tracing her eyelids. She was in her bed. The heavy feeling still hadn't left, so she got up to make a coffee. She had a cold shower while the coffee brewed in an attempt to blast some feeling into her body. Nothing. The loneliness had sunk in. She could hardly open her eyes. She brought her coffee upstairs so she could check on the baby. She looked different in the light. Her blonde hair glowed in the morning sun. Fran winced as a sip of coffee burnt her upper lip.
Look, I don't know why I feel like this, Sandra. I feel nothing for her. Just don't feel like she's mine,
Fran said flatly. She was sat in the kitchen now, nursing a cold coffee. She heard Sandra's disembodied voice through the phone.
It's all right, Fran. This'll change. My mum was like this when she had me. It's postnatal depression, love. It can happen to anyone. Honestly, don't worry about it. Look, I'm going to put you in touch with my therapist. She works wonders. We'll get through this.
Fran could sense the worry in Sandra's voice, but she accepted her offer. Fran sat staring at the kitchen table until a wail snapped her back into the room. It was dark now. She pushed back her chair and began to drag herself up the stairs. Suddenly, the noise stopped dead. Fran stood stock still, paralyzed. Then instinct kicked in and she bolted for the door. Standing over the crib was a shadowed figure. Fran stared wide-eyed as she saw the figure lean into the crib, place down a darkened bundle, and with a clawed finger go to caress it. Fran fumbled for the light switch on the other side of the bedroom door, but as she looked back into the room, the figure was gone. The curtains fluttered with a gentle breeze. The cold grazed her toes as she rushed over to peer into the tar-black night. She was alone. Turning back to the crib, she studied the baby's features. She couldn't see anything different with her. Not a mark. She hadn't even stirred. Fran slumped against the crib and sobbed. Was she losing her mind? As she slipped into unconsciousness, she swore she heard the sound of a party dancing on the wind outside the window. She awoke, knowing exactly what she needed to do. It was certain in her mind. Nothing had been clearer to her in her whole life. She just hoped he would be there. Leaving the house that Friday night, she went straight to the Winged Dawn to find the old storyteller. When she got there, the pub was occupied by only a few regulars. In the corner, calmly setting up his stage, was the small, brown-clothed man. She marched directly towards him. Grabbing him by the shoulder, she pulled him round and looked him directly in the eye.
How did you get in?
The man was unfazed.
Hello, dear. And what does me this honour?
What did you do to the kid?
Do? To your child? Nothing. Anyway, I'm sure congratulations are in order.
You were in my child's room last night and you did something to her.
Fran was beginning to doubt her own words now as those eyes stared back at her.
Ah, you've been visited. Cuckoo, cuckoo.
He cawed as he gave her a wink and began busying himself with his stage again.
Cut the fucking crap.
Some of the regulars began to turn around to hear what the commotion was about.
Nothing to cut, my dear. But I can assure you now that that baby is not yours anymore. You should have paid closer attention to me. Fairies are not one to forget a curse. I would not meddle with their changeling. Only sadness and regret lays down that path. Best to imagine nothing ever happened and carry on as normal.
Fran was speechless. She turned to leave, making for the door.
Oh, and Fran,
called the gruff voice.
When you get a moment, could you bring back my purse? It is not wise to steal from strangers. You never know who you might be taken from. There are wild folks in these parts.
Fran leant into the door and staggered into the biting air. It was only after she got back to her front door that she realized she never told the storyteller her name or of her family's curse. She stood above the crib, gazing down at the shuffling bundle. There was only one thought in her head now and only one thing to do to make it go away. Her hands reached down into the crib, gripping the sleeping child. It stirred gently, but didn't wake. In a trance, she wandered over to the window, which was again wide open. She didn't take any notice that she had never opened it, just took it as a sign. The child's blonde hair glistened in the moonlight. The air bit at her fingers as she fed her hands through the window. She didn't hear a thud. She didn't feel the weight leave her hands. She just felt the relief. The sense of freedom. She smiled. Smile again. The padded room was more comfortable than she thought it would be. The belts were like a hug from a kind lover. The glaring whiteness more like a cozy nightlight. Fran could hear the voices outside again.
How's the patient?
Well, she hasn't stopped smiling since she got here. But she also hasn't said a word in over a month. We believe it to be a defense mechanism set up from her muscles to hide any hurt she might be feeling inside. Let's take a look, if you would like.
A small slat in the door snapped open and two pairs of eyes peered in, both piercing blue with icy coldness. Then the door clicked open. And in stepped an elegant couple, both with long, flowing, golden hair, dressed in white uniforms. Fran didn't move. Didn't speak. In unison, the doctors knelt down to meet Fran's eyes. She didn't blink. She just smiled blankly.
Francesca, how are we doing today? This is Dr. Dawn Howson. She has come to help me in your assessment. As you know, you are here after being found guilty of murdering your daughter. We are here to guide you to recovery. We understand you were in a state of depression when it happened. We want to make you feel better.
Nothing.
Let me, Doctor. Fran, can you look at me, please?
Fran, we really need to know why you did it so we can understand how best to help you. We want to know with what eyes you see this world.
Fran blinked, and her focus fell upon the gaze of the woman. As she looked, the padded walls began to bulge and flex. The floor began to burst with flowers. The woman began to smile.
We see you, Fran. We know you see us.
The voice came from inside her own head.
We want you to know something, Fran. The line between truth and fiction is as thin as a knife's edge. You must be sure which side you're on when you choose your path at the crossroads of life.
Branches began to sprout from the ceiling, reaching down towards Fran's head. Ivy started to wrap itself around her ankles and wrists. As she stared, wide-eyed, grinning from ear to ear, she saw emerging from the darkness between the trees a small child.
Come here, Astral.
The girl trotted over and hugged the knee of her father.
This is Astral. I am her father, Rowan. She has always been ours, ever since your ancestor brought her into our world. The curse we brought upon her began and ended with her.
Us folk are strict but not cruel. We would never curse a whole bloodline. You were never under our command, Fran. We want you to know this. You were never cursed. Your child was your own, never ours. We've come to settle your mind on this fact. One day we hope you can see her once more.
With that, the queen and king stood. They each took a hand of their infant and, without turning back, melted into the woods. The fixed grin on Fran's face never faded, even when a single tear rolled down her face. Her knuckles went pale as she clenched something tightly in her fist. It was only when the therapists came to sedate her did her grip loosen and a small leather pouch fell onto the padded floor.
By Alex Campbell, James Ryan, and Jez Stevenson. Series introductions read by Helen Coverdale. A Folk production. Audio editing by Michelle Bailey, Liam Scarth, and Matthew Nicholson.
Creative Collective, produced by Folk.